It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Talia.
Hey, Tanya. Don't ask me.
I know. You saw me take a breath and you're like, yeah, don't ask. I won't.
It's fine.
I won't, but I would just like to welcome everyone back to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. Ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. And if you haven't already, please hit the subscribe or follow button because it helps us out a lot. A lot.
It does.
So today I'm going to tell you the story about David Arnold Brown.
I hope it doesn't offend anybody if I chew gum.
Oh, well, if it does.
I'm going to be chomping on gum.
I am not going to stop you today, okay? I'm not going to scold you for anything.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Because I love you, Talia.
Today's my day.
Today's your day to be
whatever I want to be.
Yes, exactly. Okay. David Arnold Brown was born in Phoenix, Arizona on November 16th, 1952. He was the sixth of eight children born to Arthur Quinton Brown and Manuela Estrada Brown. Arthur was an auto mechanic who often held down two jobs to keep his family fed and housed while Manuela stayed home. I mean, there's a lot. Eight kids. She stayed home with the kids.
Oh my God. I'd stay in a mental institution with those kids.
That's a lot of children.
That's insane. I have four.
And that's a lot.
You've already seen me today.
Yeah. And it's a lot of kids. I have one. I can't imagine like more than two. I think.
Well, I can.
When the kids outnumber the adults,
Yeah. Let's not talk about it.
I know.
We've already talked about that earlier.
We have. So in 1960, the Browns moved to Needles, California, which is a tiny border town in the Mojave Desert. As David grew up, his family moved constantly, following whatever jobs his dad Arthur could find. David had a pretty hard childhood. He began working at age 11, pulling weeds, washing dishes in a cafe, and then running a small local gas station all by himself. I don't know who put him in charge of a gas station at so young, but
I can't even get my 11-year-old to do the homework.
I know.
Let alone run a gas station.
Exactly, okay. Right?
All right.
He's a pretty enterprising kid, apparently. At 14, after completing the eighth grade, he left his parents' home. He would later say that his reason for leaving was due to the severe beatings he was subject to. He also claimed that he was molested by a male relative and just that he was tired of being poor and powerless. Either way, David was a survivor.
I'm sure they were really poor.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. It's eight kids.
And the dad's the only one working?
Mm-hmm. Even at two jobs. I mean, how could he possibly? That's a lot of people. So David pushed on. By the time David was 15, he was smart, a smooth talker, and obviously, as we kind of hinted at, a hard worker. As he passed through puberty, he had a distinct and extremely deep voice that commanded attention. But aside from that, his acne-ridden face and his pudgy body wouldn't command the attention or attraction of most girls. This is a big reason why David liked his girlfriends young and naive. He discovered early on that some young girls who were products of impoverished homes, both by lack of material goods and loving parents, were emotional blank slates with which he could do whatever he wanted.
They were vulnerable.
They were. With his talent for manipulation, he learned to program such girls to selfishly please his own desires. Unfortunately for him, each girl eventually grew older and learned there was more to the world than just David and only the select things he wanted them to know. Once they were no longer obedient to him, he got rid of them and moved on to his next
younger victim.
Exactly. David met his first girlfriend at age 15. Her name was Brenda Kurgis. She was the oldest of 11 children.
Oh, shit.
I know, damn.
I thought Abe was gone.
Damn, I know. Hi. Right? And she was the one that her mother leaned on for the most help when raising her siblings.
She's probably one of the oldest.
Exactly. Brenda was pretty much robbed of her childhood by having to take on these immense responsibilities. Her family was poor, and she really had nothing more than the clothes on her back. She was miserable and, of course, the perfect target for David. Even before they began dating, Brenda was already seeing someone else. But when David politely asked Brenda's boyfriend if he could take Brenda out just once, the boyfriend was like, sure.
What?
I know.
Hell no.
Right? Must have not been too serious about her. But before their date was even over, David told Brenda how she was now his steady girlfriend. Like, okay, you're mine.
That's moving fast.
Yeah, very much. Brenda listened to what David had to say, and she really was molded by him. His confidence alone was commanding, and as many women and girls would do in years to come, Brenda obeyed him. She idolized David. He was the first male in her life who wanted to care for her and show her the attention that she felt she deserved. He wrote her mushy poetry, bought her clothes and food, but also literally ran every second of her life. He was jealously possessive. He wouldn't dare let her out of his sight.
He was controlling.
Oh, very much. When he needed to use a public restroom, he insisted that Brenda wait for him just outside so he could talk to her through the stall door.
Okay, that's
crazy,
up.
Right? At 16, Brenda ran away with David. Even working sporadically at odd jobs, they had more to eat, more clothes, and a better place to sleep than she had ever experienced before. From the time he was a teenager until well into his 30s, David was overly preoccupied with sex. Brenda would later confirm that he demanded it at least 3 times a day.
Oh, shit.
I know, it's a lot.
Man.
So it was no surprise when she became pregnant at just 17 years old. In May 1970, the two were married. Their daughter, Cinnamon Darlene, was born on July 3rd. Throughout their 3-year marriage, David kept Brenda under his thumb. When she was anxious about getting a driver's license, he refused to help her and teach her how to drive. He wanted her just completely dependent on him. When Brenda eventually had a neighbor help teach her how to drive, David was just furious because that would give her freedom, right? She'd be able to leave. Beyond the daily sexual demands David placed on her, he was also a lot to handle in other ways. He had frequent bouts of anxiety-ridden depression, and when he didn't, he was all but totally consumed with the idea of sex. He ogled women constantly and right in front of Brenda. And he didn't discriminate. They could be young women, attractive, girls, older women, anybody. David was just interested in every single woman he ever saw. However, few seemed to return his feelings, and the more David was turned down, the more he tightened his possessive grip on Brenda. In 1971, at the age of 18, David enrolled in a program to train welfare recipients in useful job skills.
Well, that sounds nice.
Yeah. Based on above-average scores and the high school GED, David was admitted to Control Data Institute to study the emerging technology of computers. When finished, he worked at a number of data processing jobs in Orange County. Each time he climbed the corporate ladder, he did so by really exaggerating his importance and padding his resume with each new job. He was quite the bullshitter. I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah, right.
You always try to make yourself sound a little more important.
A little better than what maybe we are.
Use big words. By 1973, David, Brenda, and Cinnamon were living in Anaheim, California, and David was working at CalComp, another data processing company where he was fooling around with his coworker, Lori Carpenter, who was a skinny 19-year-old girl. As their marriage went down the tubes, Brenda became scared of David, and she asked her boss for help in moving out of her home. When David was at work, she moved their furniture into a small apartment that she had rented for herself and Cinnamon only. Then she got a lawyer.
So she did it all clandestine.
Yeah, she had to do it behind his back. David was shocked, as you can imagine.
I'm pissed.
Yes. This shy, submissive woman he had dominated for years had grown determined and knew what she wanted. He showed up at Brenda's new apartment with a rifle.
Oh, shit.
Put it to her head and made a speech along the lines of, if he couldn't have her, then nobody would. So Brenda told him, go ahead and shoot.
Oh,
she was like, wow. Yeah, she's just fed up. She said, you'll never get away. The police will come and they'll lock you up forever. So David gave up and Brenda won her life back.
Good for her.
Yeah, exactly. Since his teen years, David had been very concerned with his health. He told Brenda he had colitis, which he explained accounted for his frequent bouts of diarrhea and constant heavy perspiration. He visited doctors all the time, complaining of high blood pressure and gastric problems. David learned to manipulate people by preying on their concerns for his health. And since he cared about no one but himself, he learned to get what he wanted from members of his family by threatening to end the relationship, which is a classic psychological ploy called tyranny of the weak.
Oh.
Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Well, that's what it's called.
So you just threaten to cut everybody off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that you can get them to do what you want them to do.
I should try that sometime.
David would ultimately develop this tactic to take control of everyone in his tightly constrained little kingdom. 22-year-old David went through the divorce motions with Brenda. Brenda got child support, but no alimony, and she got all of their furniture as well as custody of Cinnamon. Per their divorce agreement, Cinnamon would visit her father nearly every weekend. As she grew up, she learned to think of David as her fun parent. The one,
of course.
Yeah, the one who always bought her things and took
her
places.
It's a weekend.
Yeah, it's a weekend dad,
right? Doesn't have to do schoolwork or anything like that.
Right, exactly. Fun dad. As soon as the divorce from Brenda was final, David married Lori Carpenter. Remember the girl he was fooling around with?
Yep, 19-year-old girl.
Yep. Soon, however, he realized that his new wife was much too mature for him, even though she was young. After 4 years of being married, they divorced. David had learned that he could never be happy, pretty much, with a woman that had an adult sensibility.
So he's 26 and on two divorces.
Mm-hmm. This wasn't just because he couldn't fully enjoy sex unless his partner had a smooth, firm body of a teenager, but also because no grown woman would put up with his behavior for long enough. His utter disregard for his partner's needs, his abrupt mood swings, incessant sexual demands, and smothering infantile behavior made women run off real quick.
Wow. Smothering infantile behavior. How long did it take you to write that?
I didn't write it.
Oh. That sounded good.
It sounded good, right? So David decided from then on that the women in his life would be very, very young. He would mold their malleable minds to do his bidding.
Like, which is illegal.
Yes, very illegal. During most of their brief marriage, David and Lori rented a small house in Riverside, an hour east of L.A. Two doors down from their house lived the Bailey family, and it was a family comprised of 11 children and their alcoholic mother.
What is this?
I know.
11 children.
What? I know. This is like the 1970s.
They must all be Catholic.
I know. Honestly, a lot of kids. A lot of kids. Linda Bailey was about 13 when David first cast a desiring eye on her. She was a very pretty girl with blonde hair, long legs, a tiny waist, and big boobs. I mean, she had a developed body at 13. David's first wife, Brenda, remember I told you about her?
Of course.
She taught him all he needed to know about growing up in poverty and the desperate vulnerability of young girls from welfare families. He told Ethel Bailey, Linda's 42-year-old mom, a sob story, basically. He said that he had terminal colon cancer, his marriage was ending, and since he had to work long hours to make a living, there was never enough time to clean his house. He said that if Ethel would let some of her older daughters do his housework, he would pay them. So to Ethel, David must have seemed heaven sent, like, oh, this is a way for the girls to make some money. As he grew closer to the Baileys, her kids found David to be a fun-loving, laughing, joking, affectionate man who took them on shopping trips.
This reminds me of Abducted in Plain Sight.
Oh my God, yes!
Would be
Abducted in Plain Sight.
Mr. Birch told.
Yes. That story was too much.
I know, I just finished the series. That's why it reminds me of it.
Oh my God, I should go back and rewatch it. That story was so jacked.
Yeah, they have a series and a documentary.
Do they?
Oh yeah.
Oh man, so if anybody hasn't seen it, you got to see it.
You got to see it.
Is it on Netflix?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hulu. Two.
Hulu 2, Abducted in Plain Sight.
And Family Friend, I think, is the show.
I haven't seen the show. I only saw the documentary.
Oh, it's just as creepy.
Oh, it's very creepy. And it's insane.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You won't believe the shit that happens.
But it kind of reminds me of this.
A little bit. Yeah, manipulation for sure. Ethel didn't know that he made a game of teaching her kids to steal anything left in unlocked cars and trucks.
What?
So he would do this, like, I think he would take them
cleaning?
On. No, like, when they took him on shopping trips, I think he would.
Hey,
yeah,
just
teach him to see what's in steal that car. Shit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's open. Check it out. Even before Lori and David separated, Lori was David's second wife, remember?
Yes.
David was seeing Pam Bailey, one of the Bailey kids, who was 16.
Oh.
However, that didn't mean he also didn't have his eye on Linda, 13-year-old Linda, if you remember.
Gross.
As well as her 5-year-old sister, Patty.
Stop it.
A skinny little towhead who idolized him. David made himself indispensable to the Bailey family. Days before the next welfare check was due, when nothing was left to eat but cold cereal, he took the kids out for burgers and pizza. Noting when they barely had any clothes, he took them to Sears and Kmart and bought them jeans, t-shirts, blouses, and shoes. When Linda turned 15, David quickly dropped Pam. So Pam was a little bit older, right? And Linda was initially 13 when he met her. So when she turned 15, he was hot on her trail. Not long after that, he announced his miraculous recovery from cancer. And since his marriage to Lori was over, he asked Ethel if he could marry Linda.
Well, why not? She's 15.
She's 15. Ethel said, well, no, she's a little too young. In fact, she said, Linda was too young to even use birth control pills she got from a free clinic. Which, I mean, technically.
She could have. But I get the point.
I get the point. She's 15. When she had learned her daughter was having sex with David, she just lost her shit.
Oh.
Yeah. She moved David in with her older brother, Rick, and his wife, Mary, to get her away from David. But by the time Linda turned 17, she gave in. Ethel gave in. Consequently, Linda and David, so Linda's 17 and David's 27.
Got married
in Vegas.
This is his third marriage.
Third marriage at the ripe old age of 27. They got married in Vegas in June of 1979. Less than 2 months later, David kicked Linda out of his rented house and sued for divorce, telling the Baileys that he couldn't be married to someone who abused alcohol and drugs. Linda was devastated because this was all bullshit. She didn't abuse alcohol and drugs.
So why did he want to get rid of her? He must have found somebody else.
Yeah, he did. He had started dating a coworker named Cindy, who was also a young mother of two. They got married in May 1980.
Jesus, this is his fourth marriage.
Uh-huh. But he continued to have sex with other women, including Linda. Oh. Linda didn't go away.
Oh.
David later say that although his fourth wife was beautiful and sexy, she was too greedy. So less than 8 months after they were married, David served Cindy with divorce papers.
Marriage means nothing to him.
No. No.
Clearly. Sorry. Just pointing that out.
Of course, this little horn dog set his sights on the next woman whom he wished to be his next wife in line. And that turned out to be none other than his ex-wife, Linda Bailey.
What?
Yes. He told her things would be different, and he wooed her back.
I thought she was an alcoholic. And
right. He wooed her back, though. He got back into her good graces. Next thing you know, Linda is moving out of her brother Rick's home and back in with David just before the end of 1980, while he was still married to Cindy. The Bailey family wasn't happy about this move. I mean, what the fuck, right?
Really?
I'm just like, really? You're going to go back to this asshole that accused you of this, and then he married some other chick?
After two months of being married?
Yes.
Okay.
She was only 17, too. But the man that had once taken care of them was now seen as scheming, finally. Finally, people are starting to see him for what he really is. However she may have felt, Ethel allowed 11-year-old Patty to move in with the happy couple.
What?
Yeah. After all, she was surviving because of the things that David would do for her and her family. So I'm sure she felt as if she had no choice. Or, I mean, I don't know. Patty was stoked since she would no longer have to endure poverty and an older brother's sexual advances.
Oh.
I think she was being abused.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. She also knew that living with David would give her good food to eat, her own room, and plenty of toys and clothes at the very least.
And she'd have her big sister there.
Exactly. And David was always nice to her. So, I mean, you know,
I bet he was.
Uh-huh. Despite his personal life being a bit of a mess, and that's an understatement, David was successful in his business life. In the late 1970s, David began to specialize in data recovery for large companies, and he first did this for the company RandomX. RandomX used a variety of methods to recover 40 to 60% of the data from crashed hard disks and other storage media. But David discovered a substance that could recover most, if not all, data.
Oh, that is pretty handy. I've had stuff crash.
He made it his secret, the heart of his data recovery procedure, and he called it the process.
Okay.
In 1980, while still working at RandomX, David started his own data recovery company called Data Recovery.
Oh, yeah. That's a unique name.
Hey, it tells you what it does, right? He soon quit his job to concentrate on work subcontracted from RandomX, and he got rich. Within a few years, Data Recovery, Inc. was grossing hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
Because of the success of The Process, David became a minor media celebrity in certain sectors of the computer industry. He told his family wild stories about how he and The Process were so important that he and his wife couldn't be on a plane at the same time because one of them had to be able to assist with The Process. I guess they're important like the royal family or something,
okay,
right?
Okay, all right.
Or like the president and the vice president. Okay. They can't travel together, right? He was full of stories and full of himself. He did much of his work from home and by the mid-1980s was devoting nearly all of his time to his parents, his wife, his daughter Cinnamon, who was now 14 and had come to live with him in the fall of 1984, and Patty Bailey, who was now 16. They depended on him for virtually everything in their lives. Fast forward now to March 19, 1985, at 3:30 a.m., a police officer was sent out on a call from dispatch stating a possible 187.
What's that?
A murder.
Oh.
That occurred at 33-year-old David's home in Garden Grove, which was a middle-class Orange County suburb southeast of Los Angeles. David answered the door, and the officer saw 17-year-old Patty weeping nonstop and cradling a bawling infant in her arms.
Who was the infant?
I'll tell you. I think my wife's been shot, said David. He added that his wife was in the bedroom and that he was afraid to go look. The officer thought that was an odd statement, but chalked it up to shock. As the officer opened the bedroom door, he saw a young woman lying on the bed with bright red blood oozing from her chest. 23-year-old Linda Bailey Brown had suffered two gunshots that had pierced her chest between her breasts and was now dead. Police found the weapon that had fired these shots on the bedroom floor. It was a chrome-plated .38 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver. Homicide investigator Fred McLean and Detective Steve Sanders showed up around 5:30 a.m. And after walking through the crime scene, they found three empty prescription pill bottles with the lids off next to an empty drinking glass. The pill bottles contained Darosat N.
That's a painkiller.
Mm-hmm. And Diazide.
What's that?
Diazide's a diuretic, usually prescribed to people with high blood pressure.
Okay.
But if you, you know, it purges excess water in your system, but if you take a massive amount, it could cause a severe, like, heart arrhythmia, and you could die from a heart attack if you overdosed on that. But so they find this empty bottle. Both of these medications were prescribed to David. The questions began, and David told police that after midnight the previous evening, after patching up an argument with his wife, Linda, he went on a long drive by himself. He remembered stopping off at a local convenience store and later at a coffee shop as he made his way to the beach. When he returned, it was about 3 a.m., and Patty had greeted him, shaking and crying with the news that she thought Cinnamon had possibly killed Linda.
Cinnamon?
Cinnamon. And she claimed that Cinnamon had taken a shot at her, too.
So Cinnamon's only 14, right?
Yeah, Cinnamon's only 14. David said that for months, his daughter had been disturbed and disobedient. Cinnamon was insufferable to her stepmother, Linda, to her mother, Brenda, and to Patty, with whom she held a sisterly bond with. She's 14 and Patty's 17, so they're kind of close. And she shared a room with Patty. David tried to get Cinnamon into counseling, but she refused. When asked where Cinnamon was, neither Patty or David could say. Apparently, she had upset her stepmother so much in the past few weeks that she had been banished to a small trailer in the backyard. When the police checked the trailer, Cinnamon wasn't there. When Patty was questioned next, she told police that Cinnamon came into her room at about 11 p.m. that night with a small gray gun and asked her how it worked.
Hmm.
Like, this is weird, right?
Yeah, I'd be like, well, girl, what yeah, are you what? Doing?
Why do you have this
Why
gun?
Why do you want to? Like, no, you're 14. Put that gun down.
Put it away. The gun described wasn't the revolver that police had already bagged and would ultimately prove was the murder weapon. So it was probably just another gun in the house. Just after 2 a.m., Patty said she had been sleeping in her room and was awakened by a gunshot to find Cinnamon standing next to her bed. She said that when she opened her eyes, Cinnamon ran from the room. Then Patty heard 8-month-old Crystal, who was Linda and David's baby daughter, crying. Then she heard another shot farther away and froze, lying in her bed. As she remained still, she heard a third shot. She waited a few minutes before she got up and forced herself to go into the nursery, where she picked up Crystal, who was just screaming. And she walked around the room wondering what to do and whom to call.
Right.
Right. An hour later, Patty said she heard a faint rapping at the front door. Afraid it might be Cinnamon, Patty did nothing. Then she heard the knock again. This time, she went to the door and waited in the entryway. Finally, she heard the scratching of a key in the lock. Moments later, David came in. She said that when she told David that Linda had been shot, she begged him to go check Linda's room, but he refused, saying he was terrified of blood.
Okay.
I know. He told Patty to open the door and look, but she was equally scared of what she might find. So no one apparently went in the room to check on Linda.
And nobody called the police.
Yeah, not yet. This. Right. I mean, I don't know if Linda's bleeding to death. I don't know if she's still alive. I don't know if she's dead, but nobody would go check. At this point, the police ordered a gunshot residue test for David and Patty. Before I tell you what happens next, we're going to take a break.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When police began searching the backyard, they noticed that one of the dog houses wasn't empty. Looking inside, homicide investigator McLean found Cinnamon, semi-conscious, curled into a ball, laying in a pool of her own vomit. In the vomit were dozens of orange-tinted capsules. A roll of pink construction paper was clutched in her right hand, which read, quote, "Dear God, please forgive me. I didn't mean to hurt her," end quote. At the police station, Cinnamon was taken to a holding cell. Almost immediately, she began to complain of a terrible headache, and then she vomited. Under questioning by paramedics, Cinnamon said she had taken the entire contents of 3 prescription drug vials. Diazide, which I told you earlier, that diuretic. And I told you, you know, you could have a massive overdose, which could cause a heart attack. She took an entire bottle of Darvocet and the painkiller. And if you overdose on that, it depresses the central nervous system. But she didn't die. I think it's because she threw them up. I don't know what the third drug was, but the paramedics concluded that if Cinnamon hadn't vomited up many of the estimated 260 pills
swallowed,
she would have been dead long before the police found her. She changed out of her clothes into a prison jumpsuit, and the officers read her Miranda rights. Even though they knew she might not understand these rights, they pressed on with questions, complaining of being tired. And she's a kid, you guys. I mean,
right. And she just OD'd.
Yeah, they really shouldn't be questioning her like this, but complaining of being tired and frequently drifting off, she seemed genuinely shocked and upset to learn that Linda was dead and that she was under arrest. She kept rambling and backtracking. She said that her stepmother had ordered her out of the house, adding that if Cinnamon wasn't gone by the time she woke up in the morning, Linda would kill her. Cinnamon rambled on about how Linda was jealous of her relationship with her father. Cinnamon loved her father very, very much. She said she found the gun in her dad's office and denied asking Patty to show her how to use it. Evidently, the shot in Patty's room was an accident. And the gun hammer got stuck on something odd. Like, that's what she was saying. 20 minutes into the interview, Cinnamon could barely keep her eyes open. It was obvious she was in bad shape.
How do I feel like I know the story?
You might. It was on Oprah a long time ago. I think probably when it happened. Her blood pressure and pulse were so low that she was hooked up to an IV and rushed to the hospital. For several hours, slipping in and out of consciousness and vomiting periodically, Cinnamon, without being prompted, mumbled several times to an officer sitting at her bedside. The officer thought Cinnamon sounded robotic or programmed. "She was hurting me," said Cinnamon. "She hated me. She wanted to kill me. Wanted me out of the house." Around noon, Cinnamon slipped into unconsciousness and she struggled for her life for 3 days.
Wow.
I know. After finally coming to, she gave a detailed statement admitting that she had taken the pills, pulled the trigger, and went to the doghouse, where she remembered urinating on herself and vomiting before passing out. The case was assigned to a DA deputy, Investigator Jay Newell. And Newell wasn't convinced the case was so cut and dry. He began poking around their lives and talking to the neighbors, talking to friends and family. A few things came out from these interactions. He learned from friends that Cinnamon had an extremely strict father who continually grounded her over minor infractions, such as returning home late from school or talking back. On the weekends, Cinnamon was often confined to her trailer and allowed into the house only for meals. She hadn't had telephone privileges for months and had been denied visitors.
So she was isolated.
Mm-hmm. Cinnamon's mother, Brenda, said Cinnamon had told her a few weeks before the shooting occurred that Linda and David were not getting along. Cinnamon told her she overheard Linda on the phone plotting with her twin brother to, quote, get rid of David, end quote. She said David had also mentioned hiring a private investigator to keep an eye on Linda. Investigator Newell also learned that both Patty and Cinnamon were taken out of school just weeks before the murder. David hired a top-dollar defense attorney who had a psychiatrist go to the hospital and talk with Cinnamon. When she told the psychiatrist about shooting her stepmother, she couldn't differentiate between what she had done and her feelings about it, and she insisted that she never wanted to kill Linda. The psychiatrist observed that although Cinnamon now understood that she faced going to prison, she didn't seem to care about that in the slightest. Instead, her biggest concern was keeping her father's love. She was very worried that he wouldn't love her anymore because she had shot Linda. Sounds like brainwashing.
Right.
4 months after her arrest, Cinnamon was living in juvenile hall, visited occasionally by her father, and completely unaware of the changes that had occurred in the Brown household since the murder. David, Patty, and Crystal had moved into a new house where Patty prepared the meals and served them to the family from Linda's chair. She now wore Linda's clothes and jewelry.
Her little sister.
Yeah, and that's Linda's little sister. Right. Yeah, is Patty.
So now she's just taking over the role.
Yep. Just as her late sister had done, Patty accompanied David on business errands, and within weeks of Linda's death, Patty removed all pictures of Linda from their frames, putting photos of herself in their place.
So how long till they get married?
I know, right?
That's the question.
Exactly. Over the 6 months following Linda's death, David systematically deposited the double indemnity death benefit checks that trickled in from 4 insurance companies.
Wow.
Together, they totaled $843,000.
Wow. Yeah. And this is what, in the 70s?
This is 80s. In 80, like 85. 84, 85, yeah. David, who continually reassured his daughter of his love for her, didn't testify at her trial. Instead, on the day he was scheduled, he sent word that he was too ill to come to court. The judge found Cinnamon guilty of murder in the first degree, murder with premeditation and deliberation with malice aforethought, and he sentenced her to life in prison, which meant she would remain in the California Youth Authority custody until she was 25. In time, Investigator Newell learned that just 3 weeks after Cinnamon went off to prison, David bought a new house in Anaheim Hills, which was one of the area's most exclusive residential communities. It had spectacular views of Santiago Canyon and came with a swimming pool. It cost David about $330,000, in which David had paid cash.
Oh, yeah, because he's got lots of money.
Exactly. That life insurance, that double indemnity. Wow. Also learned that between August 1985, when Cinnamon went behind bars, and the spring of 1988, David bought a $60,000 motorhome, a $70,000 Mercedes 560 convertible.
Nice.
a $30,000 Mercedes 190, two Ford Broncos.
How many cars does he need?
Too many. three Nissan Sentras.
What?
A Dodge pickup with a camper shell.
What is this?
Ford and Chevrolet station wagons. Altogether, 14 expensive cars what? And trucks.
What?
I know.
Where is he putting them?
In his new place. I don't know. Patty, 17 at the time when the murders happened, was under David's tightest control. She didn't go to school. She had no regular contact with people outside of the Brown household. She rarely left the house, alone, or with anyone except David. He insisted that she wear a pager at all times and beeped her constantly. Remember pagers?
Yeah. Yeah.
Often from the next room, he would beep her, to check on her whereabouts and activities. At home, Patty used the phone only on a speaker or as David listened on an extension. So Patty,
he's just totally controlling her.
Like he always did with all his wives. In the beginning, David would visit Cinnamon often, but the longer she was in there, the less he would show up. He kept her commissary account supplied with funds. That was so nice of him. And allowed her to charge mail order items to his credit card. But she had no way of getting a hold of him. I don't know why, but apparently not. However, when he did visit, he played the loving, doting father and constantly promised her up and down that he was working on getting her free.
Mm-hmm.
And he never talked about Patty. In fact, he said that she had moved out of his house and was off caring for Crystal on her own, which was a big fat lie. He complained about his poor health and the constant demands on him from his family. Cinnamon worshipped her dad, so she hated to hear that he was struggling.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. He's struggling?
Yeah, I know, right? But the thing is, she only felt bad because she didn't know about the magnificent new house and fleet of pricey cars he recently acquired. She also didn't know how Patty had completely taken over Linda's role in the household. Cinnamon didn't even know that her father married Patty in Las Vegas on July 1st, 1986. He married her the year after.
Fifth wife.
Yes. In fact, no one knew about this marriage. David had gone out of his way to falsify their marriage license application, thinking that he could, if necessary, deny that they had ever been legally married. There had been no rings exchanged, no announcement, and no honeymoon. But all Patty seemed to care about was being David's sixth wife.
Well, oh, sixth wife?
Well, he married.
Oh, yeah.
He Linda married, twice. Yeah, he married Linda twice. So he was the sixth. I guess you could count her twice.
It gets confusing.
There's so many women I know. And how he was finally all hers. When Patty got pregnant, David was so upset that he told her to get an abortion, but she refused. David then felt forced to invent a boy named Doug, who he would say had gotten her pregnant instead. He wasn't going to own up to being a father. On September 29, 1987, Patty gave birth to David's third daughter, Heather. When Patty got stretch marks and wasn't his little hottie anymore, he looked elsewhere.
Of course.
Of course. While he continued to deny being Heather's father. Due to this, Patty made a suicide attempt by slashing her wrists, which she received no sympathy from. Just some minor scars. Investigator Newell wanted to talk to Cinnamon, but was restricted to do so until she turned 18, unless he had parental consent. Instead, he opted...
Well, what about Brenda giving parental consent? I guess you have to have both parents.
Yeah, I think you do have to have both parents. Yeah, I think you're right. Instead, he opted to take pictures
of... Why can't Brenda tell her what's going on?
I don't even know if Brenda knows.
Oh.
I mean, she was out of the loop, I think. Instead, what Investigator Newell did was he opted to take pictures of David's pricey new estate and of the old one. He took these to the Ventura School and gave them to Cinnamon's parole officer, telling him all about the Browns' big houses, all of their expensive cars, and their Las Vegas vacations. He also talked about her new half-sister who was just born, which she also knew nothing about. 2 weeks after turning 18, Cinnamon called Investigator Newell. She was ready to talk, but only if she could be sure of protection from her father.
Something about this is clicking with me that I've heard it before.
Yeah, you might have. It's
because we didn't do it before, right?
No, we have not done it. No.
We never
do. No, I promise. I think I would remember this one if we did it before. What Cinnamon told Investigator Newell is just fucking wild. She explained that Patty and David had told her that Linda was planning to kill David for his insurance. Or for his business, and that Linda's twin was in on it, because Linda had a twin brother, remember? And so when David learned this, he told Patty and Cinnamon that they would have to get rid of Linda, Otherwise, he would have to run for his life, abandon the family, and most importantly, abandon Cinnamon. And these girls were so reliant on him, and he had brainwashed and manipulated them so much that that's all they knew. So his possible absence terrified them. Cinnamon also reported that weeks before Linda's murder, she saw David and Patty kissing. Not kissing like a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law either, but kissing passionately.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Cinnamon recounted hearing endless discussions about how to kill Linda, forcing her out the door of the van while driving on the freeway, dropping an electrical appliance in her bath, poisoning her, like all these different ways. David and Patty had talked about doing away with Linda for more than a year. But there was also the clear implication that Patty and Cinnamon would have to do the actual killing. David just couldn't stand violence, couldn't stand the sight of blood.
I don't like blood.
I don't like blood. I can't do it.
You're going to have to do it for me.
Right. Fucking asshole. Anyway, almost 3 years after the day she was confined to juvenile hall, Investigator Newell and Detective Fred McLean sat down with Cinnamon. Adding considerable detail, Cinnamon told essentially the same story she had told Investigator Newell over the telephone. She said that during the seven-month period before the murder, Patty and David had frequently discussed ways to kill Linda. At first, she thought it was one of her father's practical jokes until he set her straight. "Just believe me," he told her. "I'm your father. I know Linda's trying to kill me." Day after day, week after week, month after month, David and Patty told Cinnamon that killing Linda was the only way out. In time, Cinnamon's fear that her beloved father might actually leave became her dominant feeling.
Well, then why doesn't Patty do it?
Right? She could face almost anything but losing him. It was the big lie repeated over and over by the most important figure in her life. And since she'd been isolated from everyone outside the household, her family was all she knew. After 7 long months of this, Cinnamon finally agreed to help. About a month before the murder, David and Patty took Cinnamon along to a chiropractic appointment. On the way, David said, "We have to get rid of Linda as soon as possible. She's going to kill me soon. We can't delay it anymore." When Cinnamon said that she wasn't sure she could go through with it, David told her, "If you love me, you'll trust me. Just believe what I say. I'm your father. I know what's best."
How about he just call the police and report that, like, Linda's trying to kill him?
Well, because she's not.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's a lie.
Yeah, it's a big fat lie. David asked Cinnamon to shove Linda out the door of their van while they were on the freeway. He said he would leave the door loosely latched, but Cinnamon had to be the one to push Linda. Cinnamon refused, saying she wasn't strong enough.
Yeah, that's a little much.
"Then you don't love your father. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any hesitation. You just do it," said Patty. The weekend of St. Patrick's Day, David loaded the whole family in the van for a trip to the mountains, where he planned to have Cinnamon shoot Linda. But Linda ended up wanting to head home early. The next night, Linda died in her own bed. Finally, Cinnamon said what happened the day of the murder. After dinner and a card game, Linda hopped in the shower. When she was in the bathroom, David joined Patty and Cinnamon in the living room. He said, quote, "We have to do it. Any day now, she can kill me. Do you want her to kill me? It has to be done. Cinnamon, if you really love me, you'll do it." Several days earlier, under David's guidance, Cinnamon had written several suicide/admittance notes. Now David selected one and told her to destroy the others. Cinnamon and Patty then went to sleep in Patty's room. When 2 a.m. rolled around, David came into their room to wake them up. He told Cinnamon to follow him. He led her to the kitchen where he told her to get a glass of water. He then took out the 3 bottles of pills and told her to take them. "I want it to look like you tried to kill yourself in case it doesn't go through," he said.
"But what if I did die, Dad?"
I know, right? Cinnamon didn't want to take the pills, but when David insisted, she promptly swallowed the capsules until they were all gone. On her father's orders, Cinnamon went to the larger of the 2 doghouses. Dizzy and nauseated, she curled up on the floor of the doghouse. From there, she could hear David leaving in his car. Then a little later, she heard the 3 gunshots. After some more time passed, David appeared at the doghouse and told her, "Remember what I told you before. You're not going to get into trouble. If they ask, you did it."
Okay.
When Cinnamon was in the hospital recovering from her overdose, David told her that her lawyer said it's not a good idea to remember the night of the shooting. So she developed amnesia, and until this interview, had never spoken about the killing again. When detectives asked why Cinnamon decided to talk, she said because her father had lied to her. He lied to her about fathering Patty's baby, about being too sick to visit her, and about sending Patty away after Cinnamon went to jail. She slowly began to realize that her father had lied to her about everything. 2 days later, on August 13, 1988, Cinnamon wore a wire for Investigator Newell while she was visiting with David. She kept trying to get David to tell her exactly why Linda had to die. Once again, David spun a web of lies and confusion for her. He talked about how the mob was out to get him and his precious process, and that Linda and her brother had been plotting to kill him. He acknowledged mixing a drug cocktail for Cinnamon to drink before the murder. He told his daughter, "She couldn't tell the true story because everyone who knew beforehand would be imprisoned. She should continue to claim lack of recollection." Then David went as far to persuade Patty to confess and take the blame so Cinnamon could be released. When she asked why he couldn't take her place and tell the truth, he said he couldn't go to jail because of his various health problems.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He said he couldn't survive incarceration. And
therefore, she should.
Yeah, right. And he was going to find a way to kill himself before the first week was through. Right. So you should do it. His daughter. His teenage daughter.
That's gross.
She asked him about who the father of Patty's baby was, and he told her some guy named Doug. Then she asked her father about Linda's insurance, and David went into some complicated explanation about how when Linda died, the insurance company canceled all of her policies, so there was no money. But Cinnamon knew better. By the time David left, Cinnamon knew for the first time just how much her father had lied to her.
And how easy it was.
Yeah, and how easy it was. And for the first time, the detectives were convinced that David had used mind control as an instrument for murder. After the visit, David talked to Patty and directed her to promise Cinnamon she would confess and take his daughter's place. On August 27th, about 2 weeks later, Patty and David came together to visit Cinnamon, who was wired once more. Patty promised to trade places with her and told her various lies to make Cinnamon doubt her own sanity. It's fucking gaslighting her, I'm sure. David reminded her to keep claiming lack of memory. When Cinnamon pushed on and began asking Patty about Heather, Patty didn't deny that David was the father. Also, in a momentary lapse, Patty acknowledged that she loved David and still lived with him. By the end of the day, what was recorded was enough to incriminate the two. Now police had a motive for Linda's murder, lust. When Linda was out of the way, Patty could have the man she'd always desired, gross, and David could have a new, unspoiled woman.
Young woman.
Young one. The second motive, money. It didn't take Detective McLean long to turn up four different life insurance policies on Linda, each indicating that it was the only such policy. They finally had enough information to get a judge to reopen the case. Arrest warrants for David and Patty were issued on September 21, 1988. There were two charges, murder and conspiracy to commit murder. They were arrested the next morning. Late in October, Investigator Newell and Detective McLean decided to go back to Ventura to interview Cinnamon again. Before doing so, they called to give her a heads up and explain that since her testimony would be the key to convict Patty and David, if she lied about anything on the witness stand, the defense would use that to undermine all of her testimony. In other words, have you told us everything?
Right.
And have what you told us, the truth?
Truth.
That's when Cinnamon responded, quote, "I was ashamed. I couldn't tell you the whole truth. I just couldn't say it.
Oh, shit.
I was the one who actually pulled the trigger." End quote. Right?
Fuck.
They revisited the story once again. So let's pick up at the suicide notes. Remember, David wanted to write these suicide notes. So after David had selected one of the suicide notes, he and Patty had spoken together so softly that Cinnamon couldn't hear what they were saying. In the kitchen, after she swallowed all of the pills that David had given her, David insisted that upon shooting Linda, Cinnamon was to shoot herself in the head. But just a nick.
Just a nick?
Yeah, just a nick. Don't, like, actually kill yourself.
Oh, okay. Let me see how that works.
You know, a 14-year-old.
I'm an expert at nicking myself in the head with a gun.
Like, what? Are you fucking kidding me?
That's horrible.
I know. But he wanted it to make it look like Cinnamon tried to kill herself.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. I get it, but she could have.
She could have, right. I mean, she took all those pills, too.
Right.
Like, either one of them could have killed her. He just wanted her out of the way. I mean,
and she's taking these pills and going to try to aim to nick her head?
Yeah, seriously. Obviously terrified, she refused to shoot herself. Finally, David gave up, assuming the medication she'd already taken would have to do for the suicide attempt. David said he was going to leave the house, and when he came back, he expected Linda to be dead. Just before leaving, he gave Cinnamon a pillow and told her to put it over the gun when she fired to muffle the noise, he explained.
Why?
I don't know. I know, neighbors. David had another whispered conversation with Patty and then left. A few minutes later, when Cinnamon wandered back into her bedroom, Patty was wiping a .38 revolver with a towel. She handed Cinnamon the gun and showed her where to put the pillow when she fired. One of them cocked the hammer back. Cinnamon couldn't remember whether she did it or if Patty had. Cinnamon said she took the gun from Patty, but she couldn't remember how she got from her room to Linda's. She remembered only standing in front of the bed, holding the gun out, and pulling the trigger. Somehow the pillow got stuck in the gun action, so Cinnamon rushed back to Patty's room for help. The baby, awakened by the shot, was howling in Patty's arms. With the infant between them, the teenager struggled with the gun, trying to pull the pillow free. It went off a second time, the bullet missing the baby by inches, lodging in the wall above Patty's bed. Then Patty and Cinnamon heard a low sound coming from Linda's room. It was frightening, inhumane, animalistic. Linda was still alive.
Oh.
Patty gave Cinnamon the baby, and she watched as Patty cocked the hammer back on the pistol. Then Patty took the baby back and gave Cinnamon the gun. Patty told her to go back and shoot Linda again. The room was dark and silent when she entered for the last time. She pointed and fired the .38 revolver for a third time. David's plan for the perfect crime was for his beloved daughter to shoot his beloved wife and then take her own life out of remorse. Cinnamon was ready to testify against her father.
This is so fucked up.
I know, right? When David was being held in the Orange County Jail, he sent countless letters to Patty, filled with his mind control that were geared toward keeping her from testifying against him. He sent more than 50 letters.
Wow.
Sometimes writing as often as 3 times a day. And they were manipulative masterpieces designed to push all of Patty's buttons. He even wrote her letters signed by Doug.
Really?
The mythical father of her child. That ended up being the nail in the coffin. By continuing to deny that Heather was his child, David exposed all his promises as hollow. Patty said his denying being the father was the ultimate betrayal. For her, it was enough proof that she and David had no future together. Like, doing that previously wasn't the clue, right? I mean, this isn't the first time he did it. 8 days after Cinnamon told the whole truth, Patty sat down with her lawyers to talk to Investigator Newell. She was ready. She told him there had been dozens of conversations she and David had about killing Linda, many of them years before Cinnamon was ever involved. She said David had tried to get her to kill Linda. He had invented the mythical threats from Linda and the mafia. When she was 11, Patty said David had bought her from her mother for $10,000.
Oh, shit.
I know. She said life in the Brown family had been much like life in a bizarre cult. David decided what everyone thought and said and did. David decided that as long as Linda lived, she was a threat to the family's happiness. She said that David started kissing her when she was 4 or 5 years old. At 11, she was performing fellatio.
Oh, man.
I know. David told her it was something that happened in every family.
Oh, my God.
Right? And it was both necessary and completely normal. He told her that unless Patty regularly swallowed his sperm.
Stop it.
I know. He insisted she would never begin menstruating or grow breasts like her older sisters. When true to his predictions, her menses flowed and her breasts budded, Patty knew that David was the only man she'd ever want. When she was 15, he had insisted on sex. Finally, Patty confirmed for Investigator Newell virtually every detail of Cinnamon's account of the events of the night of Linda's murder. On December 19, 1988, David, who was 36 at the time, was brought to court for a preliminary hearing. Cinnamon testified, laying the whole story out that she had told the detectives. Then Patty testified, confirming what Cinnamon had said. On Christmas Day, David decided that he could no longer tolerate the trouble and inconvenience brought upon him by Patty, Investigator Newell, and the DA. So he hired a hit on all three.
Oh, that's going to work out.
I know. I love that.
Right. We've talked about that
in previous stories. I know. Nobody's going to say anything.
They'll never figure out who did that.
No, never. Richard Steinhardt met David in jail. When he confessed to David that he had a bad cocaine habit, snorting $500,000 worth of coke in 12 years, David knew that money would talk. He told Richard he was a rich man and that he would pay handsomely. David hired Richard to arrange for Patty's jailhouse murder and to personally kill Investigator Newell and the DA. Finally, Richard would engineer David's escape during a visit to the prison dentist.
What is this? Is this a joke?
I know this isn't like 100 years ago either. This is the best. I don't know. Through his brother and attorney, David converted some of his assets to cash, which were passed to the hired killer. When Richard was released from jail, David discussed each murder in detail on a payphone, surrounded by jail guards. Learning that a jailhouse snitch had overheard David talking about the murders.
Surprise.
Richard went to the authorities, who set him up with everything he needed to make David think the murder plot was still happening as scheduled. In reality, all Richard's dealings with David were observed and recorded by Investigator Newell and other police officers. In addition to the murder and conspiracy charges he faced, David was charged with 3 counts of attempted murder and with conspiracy to commit murder for those as well.
Dumbass.
After many delays, David's trial began on April 30th, 1990. Patty testified. Richard testified. Then only after Cinnamon testified about the pills David had forced her to swallow did she realize the whole story. As badly as he had wanted his wife dead, David had also meant to kill his daughter. Finally, Cinnamon realized the truth. Patty pleaded guilty to murder and conspiracy and was sentenced to life in prison. She joined Cinnamon at the Juvenile Ventura School. David was convicted on all accounts. Because prosecutors had not sought the death penalty, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In handing down his sentence, the judge said the following, quote, "You are a scary person.
Yeah.
You don't look like Charles Manson, but even Manson didn't use family. You're a master manipulator. I believe the circumstances of this case are unbelievable. If Cinnamon had gone under, you would have walked away. Mr. Brown, you make Charlie Manson look like a piker," which is a disparaging term meaning a coward or a cheat.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either.
After more than a year of letters, reports, and phone calls to the parole board from Investigator Newell and the DA, 21-year-old Cinnamon was paroled in February 1992. As for the process, remember I told you about the process that made him rich? That fluid that David Brown convinced his family was a national treasure? Well, Data Recovery, Inc. is still in business, still using the process, and a steady stream of income still flows to David in prison. And by the way, the process is nothing more than liquid ivory soap.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. That's all it is.
What?
Liquid soap. Apparently helps you recover data.
Who knew?
From hard drives. Who knew? Well, David figured it out.
Wow.
And his dumb ass made hundreds of thousands of dollars off of it. Not so dumb, I guess.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
So,
where's Cinnamon now?
From what I could gather from the internet, Cinnamon did have some tragedy later in her life when her husband committed suicide, but she got remarried to a police officer and apparently still lives in Orange County, and she seems happy from what I've seen on the internet.
Good.
So I hope that she's managed to live a normal life. I hope she got some therapy. And
Patty's doing life in prison?
And Patty's doing life in prison. And David died in prison on March 20th, 2014. I'm not sure exactly why, but he was cremated and his ashes are with his daughter, Crystal.
Oh.
So that is my story about this
crazy story. Crazy, I feel people. Like I heard it somehow, some way, but you I don't may know. Have.
I think it was big news back when it happened. So especially
it's so fucked up.
Yeah, especially when Cinnamon was released and paroled and everything. I know probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a horrible man.
I know. How could you do that to your child? Anyway, well, we've heard awful stories about people doing awful shit to their kids. So I guess I'm not surprised. But
right.
She idolized him. Like he just manipulated her. Anyway. Well, thank you all for listening. And if you
haven't
already, you're welcome, Talia. And if you haven't already, please hit that subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to. If you just can't get enough of us and you want more episodes, you can join our Patreon page at patreon.com/TNTCrimes. Or you can go to your Apple Podcast app and subscribe there. And what you'll get is one bonus weekly episode. And you'll also get
our exclusive
that are just for our paying members. And you'll also get the regular weekly episode early. We'll release it on Friday instead of Monday. And you'll get it with no ads.
And you'll get the billions and billions of other episodes that we've already exclusively released.
So if you want to check it out, go look at it. And you can also find us on social media. at Hardcore True Crime on Facebook and Instagram. And you can go to our website also to check out that Patreon information. So
yeah, I think crimesandconsequences.com.
Thank you, Talia. I think that's everything.
All right.
So until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.